Greg Sword from Texas A&M. I think I know most of the folks in the room, but thanks to everybody for being here and toughing it out. I'm going to talk about sort of a synthesis of a couple areas that are of work going on or that have been going on in the lab for a while now about nutritional ecology and how it relates to Helicoverpa zea as a pest and other noctuids as well. So I'll be, as I said, summarizing the work of a lot of folks who have been involved in this. Carrie Deans is currently a postdoc at the University of Minnesota with Bill Hutchinson. And then we have Spence Beamer at Texas A&M. Ashley Testnow, who's one of my graduate students, who's in the back. And Joe Black, who's contributing some of the more recent data that I'll be showing to you today. And then, of course, we have a range of other folks who have been important to getting this program going and kind of wrapped up to the stage where we are right now. So we're talking about nutritional ecology, and there's a growing number of examples showing how important nutritional balance is to the performance of organisms. And so from animals, when we're talking about nutrition, it can, of course, be a range of nutrients, but the two primary macronutrients that animals are foraging for, regulating their diets for, and then utilizing for growth and performance are protein and carbohydrate. So we have examples throughout the literature of, for instance, having an optimal ratio of protein to carbohydrates helps insects deal better with secondary plant compounds. Another case where it's the ratio of carbohydrates that determines the insect's ability to deal with pathogens. And indeed, there's a growing list. What's really important about this is the notion that the insects are not regulating any one nutrient. They're regulating ratios of nutrients or blends. That's a really important part. And so when I first started getting involved in cotton research, I thought, well, you know, the BT toxins are analogous to plant secondary compounds, perhaps, that we are introducing into plants. And maybe insect nutritional state will introduce some variation in how susceptible insects might be to these BT toxins. So that was the original idea that was the genesis of this project. And we focused on Helicoverpa zea. So in order to study the nutritional ecology of an organism, we need to know what that organism is actually trying to forage for out there in the environment. And we utilized a framework called the geometric framework or the geometric approach to nutrition. And in this case, it's empirical. So you actually ask the insect, so to speak, you conduct experiments and let the insect tell you what the ratio of macronutrients that it is attempting to forage for out there in the environment. And so I don't think we have a pointer, but over here on the left, that would be a petri dish, and there are two blocks of artificial diet. So we know exactly what the protein carbohydrate composition of those artificial diets are, and we let the insect forage between those, and then we weigh the diets, and we know exactly what it's consumed. With that data, there we go, we can calculate the ratio. So in any one trial, the insects would have eaten this much carbohydrate relative to this much protein. And so after you run this assay a few times, you find out that the optimal or the ratio, the self-selected ratio of protein to carbohydrate that Helicoverpa zea is attempting to achieve is about a 1.6 to 1 protein to carbohydrate ratio, so a slightly protein-biased diet. So that's when the insect is able to forage on nutritionally variable resources, and it will try to reach what we call the intake target. So once we knew that, we were able to construct artificial diets of known protein-carbohydrate ratios and adding cryproteins to these diets. So we started out with Cry1AC, and our original emphasis was to compare the insects foraging on diets at their optimal intake target relative to diets that were currently being used for resistance monitoring. And it turns out the very commonly used Southland diet has a very low protein to carbohydrate ratio. So it's very carb biased. And so, whoa, that's not where we want to go. There we go. It's very carb biased. So we constructed diets that were chemically identical but just varied in protein to carbohydrate ratio that represented the Southland diet, but also that represented this higher protein to carbohydrate ratio the self-selected intake target. And this is data that Ashley collected in the back there. And what it very clearly shows is the dose response curves is that the insects that are fed on that carb-biased diet are much more susceptible to Cry1AC. So they had a lower LC50. In fact, the LC50 was two orders of magnitude lower when they were on a carbohydrate-biased diet versus a diet that is their self-selected intake target or the ratio of nutrients that they want. So at first we were touting this as an important insight into how resistance monitoring is conducted and the need to incorporate an understanding of insect nutrition into that to get an accurate read. So one valid, very valid criticism of that data was that we used the Benzon strain, a highly inbred lab pet, basically, and folks wanted to know, and we wanted to know, what's going on in natural populations. So we set out to sample a range of populations across the U.S. At this time, this would have been 2017 to 2018, we were already having difficulty finding populations that were not resistant to Cry1AC and or Cry1AB, to the point where we could actually do experiments. We'd put so much Cry1AC in the diets that it would crush the insect as opposed to actually having a real artificial diet. But luckily we did find three populations, Minnesota, one from Mississippi, and one from Louisiana that we were able to work with. We first calculated the LC50 for each one of these populations because there was variation, and then used that as the baseline level of both Cry1AC and 1AB that we introduced to the different artificial diets. So what do we find in natural populations? This is data that we're working on the paper right now. We have a whole lot of different performance data and the effects of diet on these insects. I've tried to summarize it in the most simple way possible, and I've just ranked how well the insects survived on diets containing either Cry1AC or Cry1AB on these different artificial diets. And so Minnesota populations performed just as we would have predicted would. They got the memo. The survival was highest on high protein and the intake target diet and lowest on the low carbohydrate diet for both toxins. So things were looking good. But Louisiana didn't get the memo. So the population from Louisiana, it turned out they survived best on the intake target, but also the low protein diet, and a little bit worse on the high protein diet, and we saw no effective diet for Cry1AB. Lastly, for the population from Mississippi, we saw no effective diet for Cry1AC, but we did see the expected outcome with Cry1AB, where the insects performed best on the higher protein diet, the optimal intake target diet, and worse on the low carbohydrate diet. So of course, as we take this out to the field, things get a little bit noisy, but overall, for the majority of the cases, that populations and compounds that we tested, we did see the outcome of the higher protein diets facilitating better survival, or lower susceptibility to cry-toxins. So now I want to talk about stitching this together at the landscape scale. So, there was a great paper just recently put out by Dominic Riesig and Ryan Kurtz about the relationship between corn and cotton, and corn really driving the evolution of resistance to BT toxins in both of those systems. And what we're going to do here is fill in the gap about nutritional ecology and show how that's actually pouring fuel on the fire. So corn is, of course, it's not the only exclusive host to Filicosa verbosia, but by virtue of the massive amount of acreage, it's the first major agricultural plant that the insects found in. Goes through multiple generations early in the season. And then later in the season, the insects move into cotton. And there is actual evidence that insects that have been in corn systems are the next generation of insects that are moving into cotton later in the season. And so, if we want to know what the role of nutritional ecology is in this system, we need to know what corn and cotton are offering to the insects as nutritional resources. It turns out they're very variable within a plant, but also between plants. And so on the left, we have the protein-carbohydrate ratios that we determined empirically from a range of different corn tissues, including the kernels, which is, of course, where the insect's primarily feeding. And they're all universally carbohydrate biased or have a low protein to carbohydrate ratio. Whereas cotton is very different. In cotton, several of the tissues have a protein carbohydrate ratio that is exactly at the self-selected intake target of Helico verbosea, including the seed, which is of course what the insect's primarily consuming when it's inside the bowl. So now we could go back and look at those the dose response curves that I showed you initially, and we can reinterpret it in terms of the nutritional ecology of the insect in the field. It turns out that that low carbohydrate diet that we tested, the Southland diet, is almost identical nutritionally to corn. And the 1.6 optimal intake target ratio is almost identical to what cotton offers. So we see that the plants vary very much in the nutritional environment, and this has a direct effect on how susceptible the insects are to corn, to the BT toxins in those plants. And so in this case, corn is actually exerting a stronger selection pressure. Insects have to survive two things when they're feeding on corn. They have to survive a crappy nutritional environment and BT toxins. So it's a stacked trait with poor nutrition combined with BT toxins. And what this conceptually equates to is cotton being a soft landing. It's actually a more favorable or more permissive environment for insects coming off of a highly selective environment in corn and then moving into cotton. So I just referred to that just sort of informally as a soft landing. So there should be relaxed selection and insects coming from corn that might be less susceptible or partially resistant to cryoproteins are actually experiencing a favorable, relaxed selective environment on cotton. So what else do we have to consider in terms of management? So there's a renewed interest in pathogens, of course, biological control, but in particular, the targeted use of some entomopathogens. In particular, for Helicoverpa zea, we have available a nuclear polyhedrovirus, which is it's developed originally for Armidura, but it works perfectly well for zea. And we already knew that nutritional environment, at least for Spidoptera, affected the insect's susceptibility to nuclear polyhedrovirus. So my new student Joe, if you happen to see his talk yesterday in the student presentations, he took this on as his project to look at the role of nutritional variation in susceptibility to nuclear polyhedrovirus in this case. And I'm just going to summarize his whole talk with one of the main summary talks. Basically, again, we were able to do the same type of experiments that we did with the cryotoxins, but instead of adding cryotoxins to these nutritionally defined diets, we would add a known lethal inoculum of nuclear polyhedrovirus, and we start to see a very similar pattern. Those insects that are fed on a diet that approximates the nutritional environment of cotton do survive better, they survive longer when challenged with nuclear polyhedrovirus infection relative to those that are feeding on diets that represent corn nutritionally. And so, if we pack these both together, we have two things that might potentially be killing Helicoverpa or helping regulate Helicoverpa populations in the field. And it turns out that cotton is actually the more permissive or the more relaxed environment for insects for both of those challenges. And so it's a sort of double whammy of bad news for having so much corn grown and then those insects coming from corn onto cotton, both for transgenic proteins, but also at least for the one biological or potential biological control agent of pathogen that we've tested. And so I think I've finished in time, and we're good. All right. I was a bit worried about that, but powered through it.
Are there any questions for our speaker? We have a couple of minutes.
In principle, yes, but operationally what results from that is an insect that it has successfully overcome those two stressors, right? So it's predicted to make it less likely for the insect to evolve resistance to two different stressors. But once that does occur, then you have an insect that
the superbug.
And what's interesting is, if I can go back to this slide right here, what we start to see as it's a trend, we haven't fully documented this, but I think it's pretty solid, is as we start seeing LC50 levels go up, in other words, as there's increasing or decreasing levels of susceptibility or increasing levels of resistance, we tend to see the effect of nutrition decrease. And that's exactly what you would predict if plasticity was an intermediate stage in the ultimate evolution of what becomes a constitutive or fixed trait. So that's what I think is I think nutritional variation has facilitated the evolution of resistance, but it ultimately becomes genetically determined and nutrition doesn't matter anymore. Question in the back. Yes. It very well could. The background of the Minnesota population is they were collected from sweet corn in the field because there are no real overwintering populations there. The other two were from recently field-derived lab colonies. So they had been in the lab for a couple generations. Well, I could get the exact numbers for you. But it certainly could matter, yeah.
Let's thank our speaker.
All right, thank you very much.